Finch. Good afternoon, Mark. Matthew Finch, good afternoon. Welcome to Artbreaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us, and it's great to be out of hibernation and back on the air. It was a terrific marathon. We raised over $516,000 plus in pledges. The Frank Zappa 24-hour special with Citizen Kafka, Jim Freund, and their crew raised $36,000 alone. We were happy to hear about that in the Arts Department. And to top it off, Amy Goodman and Alan Nairn went on PBS, and when they won their DuPont Columbia Journalism Award, they really gave it to the big poobahs up at Columbia. That was the ultimate piece of WBAI Pacifica performance art. Today we're going to be talking with Jennifer Gilman, art director of the Village Voice, with artist Peter Cooper, whose new edition of World War III is all about TV, and shortly when he drops in with artist Eric Drucker, and Matthew Finch, who put together the panel, is going to co-host today. Boy, do I need it. Let's kick it off with Anita O'Day.
My name is Drew Robert. I work for the state.
I'm a sergeant. Anita, where you at, Anita? Anita.
Barracks number 8. I always done an honest job. As honest as I could. I got a brother named Frankie, and Frankie ain't no good. Now ever since we was young kids, it's been the same come down. I get a call on the short way. Frankie's in trouble downtown. Well, if it was any other man, I'd put him straight away. But when it's your brother, sometimes you look the other way. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria as a band played Night of the Johnstown Flood. I catch him when he streams like any brother would. Man turns his back on his family. Well, he just ain't no good. Well, Frankie went in the army back in 1965. I got a farm to firm, settled down, took Maria for my wife. But then wheat prices kept on dropping till it was like we were getting robbed. Frankie came home in 68, and me, I took this job. Yeah, we're laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria as the band played Night of the Johnstown Flood. I catch him when he strays. Teach him how to walk that line. Man turns his back on his family. he ain't no friend of mine. Well, the night was like any other, but I got a call about quarter to nine. There was trouble in a root house out on the Michigan line. There was a kid lying on the floor looking bad, bleeding hard from his head. There was a girl crying at a table, and it was Frankie said. Well, I went out and I jumped in my car, and I hit the lights. Well, I must have done 110 through Michigan County that night. It was out at the crossroads down round Willow Bank. Seen a Buick with a high plate, behind the wheel was Frank. Well, I chased him through them county roads till a sign said Canadian border 5 miles from here. I pulled over to the side of the highway and watched his taillights disappear. Me and Frankie laughing and drinking, nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Marie as the band plays Night of the Johnstown Flood. I catch him when he streams like any brother would. Man turns his back on his family, but he just ain't no good.
Matthew Finch hates it when I play those slow Bruce Springsteen songs, but Anita O'Day did not get a voice change, I promise you, and we'll be hearing from her shortly. We're just leafing through Peter Cooper's new edition of World War III devoted to television, and also here's Jennifer Gilman, who makes it look easy week after week as our director of the Village Voice. To what do you both attribute the triumph of artists working through the illustrative medium in high art? It's definitely in terms of sales, in terms of gallery and museum shows, and in terms of the kind of work that both of you put out. Is it its accessibility, its portability, and its disposability that makes illustration the hot medium to work in?
That's covering a lot of ground. I think that, as far as right now, it seems like in the art world, there's just desperation because nothing seems to be selling there. And as a result, I think they're looking at more things outside of mainstream fine art, and that as a result, comics is getting looked at, and illustration too. I mean, there's an illustration gallery in New York. But as far as a hot medium goes, it's definitely a place where you can make a living, the thing about working for mainstream publications is you can get it into the hands of a much greater number of people, get artwork out that way. And I'm much more interested in that than having it be an elitist few that get to see it in a gallery or get to own it and have it on their wall. And so the cheap, disposable format is perfect as far as I'm concerned.
Jennifer Gilman, when you're sorting through the various illustrations and commissions you do as art director for The Voice, do you have a sense that you're handling the high art of the future? What will be in museums 100 years from now?
Well, maybe not high art, but great thinkers. I mean, I think that the people that we're trying to work with at The Voice are people who are working through their own ideas and political ideas and really trying to communicate with a lot of people in much the same way that some of the more revolutionary art forms were happening at different times. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement. I'm not a great expert on high art, but there doesn't seem to be any movement now that's sort of taken over. And so I think people are sort of growing up from the bottom like a grassroots organization and taking control by being able to disseminate, you know, on a mass basis.
Well, I'll tell you, you're definitely getting to the high artist, though, because when Roy Lichtenstein's show opened at the Guggenheim, Ron Perlman, the conglomerateur of Revlon, made the mistake of bringing in someone dressed as Batman into the dinner, and Lichtenstein got very angry, and his face got red, and he nearly stalked out. And here, of course, was one of the first artists to deal with crossover, indeed stealing the work of other comic artists to use in his own work. Peter Cooper, let's talk a little about the new World War III. Describe the cover for us, which has six different sets, and Richard Milhouse, Nixon, and Lee Harvey Oswald, among others, and talk about its genesis for us.
Well, World War III has been around for the last 14
this
years.
This is issue number 20.
Yep. It started as just a couple of us working on it, and it's now about 30 people who put their work into it, and this particular issue, the latest TV one, was edited by me and Scott Cunningham and Kevin Pyle, and we're part of a group of revolving editors that, you know, we pass around the duties of doing that, and that also includes Seth DeBachman, who I co-founded it with, and Sabrina Jones and Sandy Jimenez, there's a number of people that have been involved in it. Just in the production, this issue we decided to focus on something that's very much part of all our lives, which is TV and the media in general. And the cover is actually a window that I painted, and it's I was just trying to express the quality of the person who's deranged by all the information that they get through television.
Let's talk about some of the contents. Donald, the Mob, and Me, that looks quite intriguing.
Irene Lindwith. It's about mob mentality and people being, like Donald Trump, being held up as these icons that are more fascinating somehow than war in Bosnia or you name it. I mean, it seems actually particularly appropriate now with all these different, you know, we're fixating on Tanya Harding and Michael Jackson and all this stuff, and it's just amazing how people can fixate on something like that, and there are so many broader issues that are threatening and have a much greater influence on us that end up being completely shuffled to one side.
And to that end, actually, World War III, I think the previous issue was dealing in recovery from sexual abuse, which was something of a departure for the group. And you commissioned a lot of artists who hadn't been seen terribly much, at least in this area, were contributing to that. It always occurs to me that as a consumer of TV, all of those tabloid cases kind of flow together. I've always felt that, like, Lorena Bobbitt's being supported so much because people really think she's doing what Amy Fisher should have done somehow. You know, she's like redeeming Amy Fisher, and you can't tell one from the other. I want to follow up on Charlie's first question, though. The when you're working, and a lot of the work you work in ink, and you also work in spray paint.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in your career, are you becoming more aware of dealing in archival materials? In other words, are you worried about what your work might look like in 20 years? And Jennifer, in the work that's coming before you, are you seeing the artist presenting it, you know, with a greater sense that this has to be preserved, or is it still just sort of there to be printed and then it might vanish?
Well, I'm definitely more concerned with whether there'll be anybody left in 20 years than I am, whether my artwork is going to survive in 20 years, but... you know, I definitely have some consciousness of that, and, you know, so it doesn't all fall apart, but it's certainly not a priority.
I think it varies from person to person. I mean, some people, you know, are at points in their careers where they're starting to think about retrospective shows as that's becoming more and more possible. I mean, Steven Kroninger just had a huge thing at the Museum of Modern Art. I mean, that was something, I mean, his work is something that got thrown away often. I mean, it's, you know, that's, it looked
because
very
of the
disposable.
Collage extra,
it looked very disposable. It looked like, you know, sometimes it was on a piece of paper, but I mean, I think people are starting to become more conscious of that as illustration galleries open and things like that. People are starting to be more aware of it as fine art. I don't know how that affects the content of the work. Maybe people take it more seriously.
But just, I was really asking about the materials.
Yeah, I don't think it affects the materials that much, except for that perhaps people are using illustration board as opposed to putting things on, you know, I mean, I think people's materials really come so much from their own vision that it's, I haven't seen it altered that much.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the field of editorial illustration, I guess we call it, because Peter, you run the gamut. You work, you know, both sides of probably five or six different fences in mm-hmm. in the work you've done. And Jennifer, although I think you have done narrative stuff in The Voice, largely you're concerned with editorial styles. In the years that you've both been doing it, have you noticed a change or a new trend? I know that when I was first aware of it as an individual art form, it seemed like someone like Brad Holland, who was all over the New York Times maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago even, was sort of a benchmark illustrator and was really, to me at least looked very influenced by Magritte. One of, you know, he would constantly have people with, you know, guns for heads. This sort of, it's an insult to call it a cliche, but it's a device that he used a lot and a lot of young illustrators began using, but I don't see that in what you do. Peter Cooper, and I'm not sure I see a lot of that going on in The Voice. I see something different there, but I wonder, can you speak to that, what you see? It seems to me, at least, like you're a narrative artist in your comics work, but even in your single cell work, mm-hmm. there's some sense that we're peeking into a story.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I always thought that illustrators would have, or working with a little bit of a handicap if they don't know something about narrative sequence, because I mean, for the way I think about an illustration, a lot of times I'm thinking about the possible different steps in a sequence and which one might capture a moment of a sequence, and just, you know, even thinking in sequential terms as far as how your eye goes into the composition, that you know since we read, you know, left to right, that you know, I've composed thinking about that, and that's also figures in with somewhat of a, you know, a narrative or reading quality in illustration. Something you said earlier, asking about the trends in illustration, I definitely see comics as, with an X, alternative material, as making inroads into mainstream publications in general. And The Voice has always had comics from their inception with Pfeiffer, but now you're seeing that kind of work in Details magazine and in Ms., Mirabella. I mean, it was in Esquire, and The New Yorker has a regular comic strip in it, so it's starting to become a more regular feature that the two, you know, words and pictures coming together like that are not, you don't have to make some huge leap. I mean, actually, The New York Times was running a strip that I did for a while, and then they canned it. But
they did?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Did you get, because the last time Peter was here, Peter was talking about it had pretty much just begun.
Right, it began
city.
And ended in about a minute. It was a very odd thing, because as far as I could tell, they just got cold feet with it, and it's not real clear just what happened, but, you know, they said it was a budgetary thing, but it seems to me they've got enough money there.
They've got, yeah.
We've just been joined by Eric Drucker. And,
hello. Hello, Eric Drucker.
I wanted to ask Jennifer Gilman. The Village Voice finished last year with a whole issue devoted to illustration, illustrating the events of 1993. Now, a year ago, Jules Pfeiffer confessed that he had a liking for Bill Clinton. And I wondered whether The Voice has been treating Clinton with kid gloves, so to speak, as an illustrative subject. Or are they, in fact, really attacking him?
Well, certainly not because of Jules Pfeiffer. But I think it varies from piece to piece and editor to editor. I mean, everyone's got, and columnists and artists, you know, each person. I mean, that's something that happens a lot. The Voice is that there isn't an editorial slant that everyone falls under. I mean, there's a lot of infighting about. I mean, when we were doing endorsements, I mean, it was a colossal controversy.
And indeed, Stan Mack did a great strip on the last Merrill endorsement
right.
meeting.
Yeah. So I think, you know, certain people are, I mean, certainly Kroninger is attacking him in various places, although maybe not as viciously, obviously, as he attacked Bush. But, you know, people have different takes on him.
Well, we're talking with Eric Drucker shortly, Peter Cooper and Jennifer Gilman, with Matthew Finch co-hosting about The Art of Illustration. Let's hear that Anita O'Day cut, and we'll be back with you shortly.
Someone else is crying their eyes out in vain. To you, it doesn't matter, for your heart feels no pain. You think that you're immune because you've never been blue, but it's different when it happens to you. When someone else is dreaming of love in despair, don't toss your head and smile and say, not my affair. Just watch your P's and Q's around that somebody new is doing. When it happened to you, I've let love is a game that no fool ever learned. But I was a fool, fools play with fire, fools always seem to get burned. When someone else keeps telling you that fate is unkind, don't laugh and say you think that it's a sad state of mind. Be careful not to fall in love with someone untrue. It's different, baby, when it happens to you. Different, baby, when it happened to you.
A few years ago, George McNeil, a terrific artist who's taught at the Pratt Institute for a long, long time, when he turned about 70, he became kind of in, and his work, which is gorgeous, has had a great influence on Tip Dunham, Terry Winters, and other artists who use cartoons in their paintings. And George has an opening tonight at the ACA Galleries. He's now about 85, and he's doing the best work of his career. That's at 41 East 57th Street on the 7th floor from 5:30 to 7:30, and you can meet George McNeil, something I recommend highly if you go tonight. You can call 212-644-8300 for information. And tomorrow night at the Salvador Ala Gallery, there's a terrific show called New York Abstract Painting, featuring work by the late Maura Dreyer, and how many well-known artists after they die become famous. I mean, we see it with Hannah Wilke's terrific show now at Ronald Fellman. It's too bad they're not around to enjoy their newfound fame. Other people on that show include Stephen Ellis, Carrie Smith, and Stephen Westfall. It opens tomorrow from 6 to 8 at 560 Broadway, the Salvatore Ala Gallery, a beautiful space on the second floor. Again, in the studio, we're talking with Jennifer Gilman, art director of Village Voice and sculptor. Peter Cooper, we're going to be talking about his terrific classics illustrated version of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And with Eric Drucker, who just arrived, I want to read something that Art Spiegelman wrote in The Nation in the January 17 issue. He says the stereotype was invented early in the 18th century as a way of making relief printing plates from paper pulp molds. It's the way newspaper comics plates were made until new technologies overtook the business in the 1960s. So comic strips were literally as well as figuratively generated from stereotypes. Cartoons are an especially effective and basic language. Babies can recognize a have a nice day face at virtually the same age. They can interpret their mother's facial contractions as a smile, and long, long before words have any meaning. So I'm going to ask our panelists in a Freudian sense, when did the love of illustration start for you? In the cradle, Eric?
I don't remember if I was in a cradle or what, but I remember being in the bathtub. My parents would tape rolls of paper around so I could make a big mess and it wouldn't matter. And just give me brushes and watercolors. So they got me started really early, which I think is a good idea with anyone with kids. Get them started from day one, because it seems that it's a natural thing. All kids are brilliant artists, you know, and then it's something that we kind of forget how to do, or it's beaten out of us, or it's not encouraged, and then, you know, then we forget how to do it. I think it's a little different from music. I think visual art is something that, you know, because I work with kids sometimes, and they seem to have a natural sense of composition and color, and it seems like some of the best artists are kids, you know, 2-3-year-old kids, toddlers, you know.
One thinks about the famous remark Dubuffet made when they compared his work to those of children, and he said, "Would that it were so," because you lose so much. But I was intrigued recently in the Times. They talked about the discovery in an antique shop of these figurines from 20,000 years ago. And the theory that the anthropologist advanced in the Times this week was that while the male hunters were doing the drawings of the hunt on the cave, the women were deeper inside the cave, actually making all the sculpture of that era. Let's talk a little bit about stereotypes and recognizability as an issue in illustration. Is that something you always look for, Jennifer, when you're doing editorial-based work for The Voice, that the reader will instantly recognize it as, say, Tonya Harding flipping around in the nude, or Bill Clinton in a smoker's jacket, or something like
that? Well, yeah. There are times when you need a specific character. You need a caricature artist who can do a likeness, although sometimes, you know, even if you're dealing with someone specific, you don't. It's an idea that you're trying to get across, and so it doesn't matter as much. I mean, we have very few caricature artists. I mean, the really good ones are the ones you're used to seeing all the time.
But does that mean the element of mystery gets shortchanged? I mean, if we think of the old Harvey Kurtzman comic books from the 50s, there was an extraordinary element of surrealistic mystery.
Well,
are we losing that with these sort of pop culture signifiers?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think, you know, for example, there was a piece a couple of weeks ago in The Voice, a Frances Jetter piece. I asked her to do a piece on Federico Fellini, and if it wasn't captioned, you wouldn't necessarily have known it was him. It was a very mysterious piece. It was the back of his head, but it had characters from his movies in it, and it had this great mystical quality, which I think was very mysterious, and yet it was still a caricature. I mean, you don't have to be limited by that, I don't think.
One thing you were mentioning with stereotypes, actually The Voice is one of a few places that you can actually draw black people so that they look like black people, rather than you have to make them into such icons that they are actually white people with black skin or black coloring.
You say you have to make that. Who's?
Well, there's certainly is pressure for it. I mean, I've been... That's the kind of thing that I will work against, but I have encountered problems where I either have to pull out of the job or come up with an entirely different solution. And I mean, I encountered it so much at different points that I guess I found myself unintentionally self-editing, but I've been moving the other direction and just basically trying to draw whatever it is in the way I want it most of all, and then deal with being cut back from there. But say the Washington Post, I had actually done a Xerox of a photo of a black guy, and they said, you know, he looks too black, and I just was like, now, let me see if I have this straight. Now, you know, it's like the level of racism there was pretty astonishing.
Well, you can also see the recent minor controversies over, I think his name is Morin, who had done a piece on for the In-House magazine from AT&T. that was people attacked it, and also Slug Sigourney, and of, well, hate to say this word, the New York Press had, who's the illustrator, on the on one of the back pages, had come under some fire for a what was termed a racist caricature, which if you saw it, certainly passed that line.
Yeah, I mean, easily. there's one thing of doing a racist caricature, and there's another thing, you know, doing something that looks like a cartoon from, you know, from the 20s, and another thing of just trying to accurately depict people, and that that one of the, another thing that comes up is that when you do every man, it's always a white person, and if you do a black person in a
and
an every man. And a man, and, that immediately it's questioned. Well, oh, if it's a black person, does that mean it's about race or something like that? You can't. It's pale male.
How do you think the culture is likely to get out of that? If there has to be, I mean, in other words, the generic figure, right? You know, Magritte put white men in coats, and that was sort of his generic figure. Do you think the culture will ever come to a generic figure? I'm thinking of, for instance, the Time magazine cover about, I think it was last week, was about locking people up and throwing away the key, and they put a criminal in the stocks. And, of course, The criminal was sort of like
Russian, maybe.
Yeah, he looked, exactly. He looked like he was from Bosnia.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So, and it goes backwards and forwards. Do you see any solution to that? I mean, as you approach it, I mean, do you draw people in profile in order to de-sex them, or what do you do?
I certainly try to do it, you know, like draw a woman when it's supposed to be every man, when I draw a black person, don't draw them as something, you know, having neutral features, it's, to a certain extent it's in the artist's court to put that forward, and then it furthermore is in the art director / editor's court to say, yeah, that's our, we're not going to block that.
It's a really difficult problem. I mean, Eric and I had a problem like that with a couple issues ago with the Hasidic voters illustration. Remember that? And we were trying to figure out how do you depict that without using stereotypes?
Person?
Yeah, I mean that are offensive. And what's the line between offensive and genuinely a signifier? I mean, you need to be able to get across the idea to people that you are talking about Jews and that you are talking about Hasidim. And how do you do that without insulting? I think it's a really tricky problem.
Yeah, without any words, how do you draw a Jewish person? Do you just draw someone like me, you know, a guy with a big nose? Or no, like it could have been an Italian guy. Or do you have to do the, you know, have a yarmulke? Then he's definitely a Jewish guy. Or it could be a, you know, Arab Muslim guy with a skull cap. But if the only way unmistakably to draw a Jewish person so that everyone gets it is to do the whole Hasidic trip with the payas, the ultra-Orthodox thing with the long coat, then everyone knows, oh, that's a Jew. There's no mistaking it.
There's a Jewish star. I mean, you could go for a strictly symbol thing. You know, the person is
the star, the conceptual, but just the guy on the street, a guy walking along, if it's, African-American, you simply have them dark skin. Although I've come across that a lot where they tell me that he looks a little too, well, they don't come out and say he looks too African, but that is the hang up. Is the skin is okay if it's dark, but the features shouldn't be too African. They want you to draw like a European looking person with kind of colored in skin.
The only thing I think that's really going to change all that is really just the culture, and people are going to be getting used to seeing images of different kinds of people, and the more we do that and take the risk of being offensive or take the risk of being accused of being offensive, you know, then the more people are going to be used to those kinds of images. They won't take it as offensive when they see someone characterized by something physical. We do that every day. It's the way we identify each other. And so as the culture starts to change and be more accepting, I think that'll happen in illustration.
Semi-notorious New Yorker cover last winter, Art Spiegelman did it for Valentine's Day of a Hasidic gentleman kissing an African-American woman. He said that he had actually toned down all the features, and yet all the complaints he got from all sides really dissing him were that the features were exaggerations and caricatures. But this issue of recognizability is something always with you, right, Eric, when you draw?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if you want to see Eric's work, take the new WBAI February March folio, well edited by Marina Ortiz, and turn to page 19, where he has a picture of a woman, a very powerful woman, swinging a mallet against a wall. and shouting resist. Is that typical
knocking
of your
hole
work?
In the wall. Yeah, no, that's typical of my neighborhood. You know, a lot of abandoned buildings and a lot of homeless people, and then the logical thing to do is to like break into the building and then move in. So,
are you a Lower East Side person?
Yeah, that's my neighborhood, and most of my work, I guess, is inspired from what I see around me in that neighborhood. I've lived there all my life, and you know, something that's always on my mind. I got a phone call a couple of days ago that they're evicting Glass House. That's the squat on 10th Street and Avenue D. And it was that freezing cold day, a couple of days when it was snowing. This was the first eviction since Giuliani has been in there.
Have you noticed, by the way, Eric, that Michael Julian, the notorious majordomo of the 9th Precinct, has actually been promoted citywide by Bill Bratton, the new police commissioner?
Right, he's the new what's his position now? What's his title?
I think he's handling internal security in the police department, but I could be wrong. Mm. But obviously he's been rewarded for inciting the Tompkins Square riot 5 years ago. How grim.
So the content of my work tends to be about these subjects, these things in the city that I see all the time, the things that I feel strongly about. I think everyone's best art is what they feel most strongly about, not necessarily an assignment that's given to them, but what they really, you know, what they feel passionate about. So I've been seeing a lot of things getting more, I don't know, more Orwellian in my adult years since coming of age, since Reagan has been in. And now it seems like if you're poor, you're criminal is the thing. That's sort of the new buzzword.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I hate the new Metropolitan Transit Authority campaign against panhandlers, where they pass out literature. I mean, if they put that much...
And they're using a thought balloon. I resent the fact that they're using a symbol from common.
This is what you're thinking. Like, yeah. This is what you're supposed
to
do.
Yeah, they impose this kind of fascist thing on everyone who's sitting there. I mean, you could be sitting there, and behind you is this thought that you're supposedly having...
You mean by the design of the poster is that if you're sitting in front of it, it looks like it's your
phone?
That's
the
design. Exactly.
You're sitting there and you're looking up and you see the thing that says hemorrhoids, you know, or a torn earlobe, and then you'll see someone sitting there and above them there's a thought balloon coming out of their head, and it's there thinking, oh, I hope this person doesn't ask me for money. Oh, why should I have to give them my hard-earned money? What does it say?
It's my money at the end. Yeah, it was just
really.
Just kind of enforcing that kind of, greed, kind of like uptight thing. Well, you shouldn't give to panhandlers, you know.
And so,
and that it's against the law now. You know, it's against the law, buddy, you know. And this is a new thing. You know, it used to be no one liked to see panhandlers, you know. No one liked to be a panhandler. No one likes to live in the park. It's sort of by default that they're at that stage. And now it's not even your choice whether you, you know, like keep reading your New York Times or you give them a quarter or something. Now it's no, they're breaking the law. You know, you should report that person and or that squeegee person and, you know, we'll throw them in jail now. That's the housing policy.
No, it was jail. When I saw that, it was like the kind of thing we would have run in World War III about 10 years ago as a nasty joke on fascism. And, I mean, we ran these sort of fake ads, you know, like, you know, funny business is no laughing matter, report people who are acting funny. And, you know, they were just mock ads. And I saw that and it was like, mock schmock. This is, you know, this is what they're putting forward.
Plus, this is like this Rush Limbaugh approach, you know, where it's like encouraging people to believe that their secret, deepest, ugly thoughts are shared by everyone around them, and that it encourages that. It encourages you to bring out that ugly part of yourself. I think it's offensive.
Now, Jennifer Gilman, Peter Cooper, and Eric Drucker, has anyone taken advantage in the illustrative crowd of Rudolph Giuliani's resemblance to a vampire?
I thought he looked like George Bush. I was looking at a photo of him, and I thought, oh, it's George Bush. Oh, wait, no, it's Giuliani. Giuliani.
Well, he's got that forehead thing. That's
I always thought Frankenstein, yeah.
I always thought he looked like a very dim light bulb myself. You know?
Yeah, well, the great thing about having Giuliani in office, if there's a silver line to any cloud, is all the illustrators are sort of rubbing their hands together thinking, oh, boy, I really can get my teeth into this one, which is a sad statement.
But has anyone actually done that yet?
What, him as a vampire?
Or in any sort of negative fashion. I don't recall seeing, even in The Voice.
Well, there was the Beavis and Butthead with that picture Koch, just that a short time ago.
Oh, The Voice has done some really good ones, Julian, already. Dozens already.
So yeah, there's
some of the best ones I've seen. You know, Eric Palma and Croninger did a full cover of, it's like a collage.
With that scary mouth.
Yeah.
He took a mouth from a magazine and he turned it upside down. And it was amazing how much it looked like Giuliani's mouth. It was chilling. I mean, that was like the focus of this piece. He had huge floppy ears. And, you know, Croninger's stuff is very rough. And sometimes when he uses just panels of color, et cetera, et cetera. But the mouth had this sick grin and it was immediately recognizable.
Smile. Yeah. Yeah, it looked just like
a model's mouth. But it was terrifying.
Peter Cooper, Classic Illustrated, issued your beautiful version of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, in full color, by the way. Now, you did this with spray painting and stencils.
Mm-hmm.
Please tell us a bit about that process. And why did you choose The Jungle?
Oh, this is a leap from Giuliani to The Jungle. Well, maybe not.
No, it's not.
I had done some work with actually with Seth DeBachman. We'd done a few stencils together that for being sprayed on the street, and some stuff that we'd done for World War III. And I really liked the quality it got. There's an immediacy to it, and a sort of a graphic nature that busted me out of certain ways I might draw, because I now have to cut with an X-Acto knife rather than using a pen. And I ended up cutting it out of like Xerox paper and then spraying it with spray paint, and it's not airbrushed stuff. And I just felt that look would give the quality of that sort of turn of the century worker poster art and also German expressionism and a lot of work that I've admired for years. And so that I thought it, you know, it would have a built-in tone to it that would be appropriate to this. And then also with comics is such an unexplored form that there's just to even do that was working in a way that hadn't been used in comics before, at least as far as I'd seen. And so it was interesting to me just to try that.
Yeah, and what's also interesting about it is that in the illustration field, a lot of the people who pick up the airbrush often end up creating something that's very sterile looking.
Yeah, that's why I stick with spray cans, is because that, you know, the nozzle starts to get messed up, and it's just there's a big X factor in it, and I'm sort of always interested in how I can sort of sidestep my tendency to, once I get something figured out, that I it starts to get tightened up. And this sort of innately always busts me out of that. And so that's always, I mean, I like the fact that when I finish spraying it, that, you know, I lift up the piece of paper and I don't know what the results are going to be until that moment.
Right, you have that moment of revelation. Just like the readers,
or
actually.
Fear.
Or fear, yeah, you got to start over again. What about some of the traveling you've done? Now, when you were here on Shelf Life, you were talking about comics trips,
right,
which was the book about your trip to Africa, to the Middle East, and to Asia. But you've also more recently, maybe not more recently, you were in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, and in fact, in World War III, you're publishing a piece from Czechoslovakia. You had a few contacts there, but what sort of scene did you find? How was the field regarded? I guess this is more comics than illustration.
Yeah, well, actually what happened was my wife Betty entered a radio contest and won first prize, which was 2 weeks in Poland. And it's not a joke, it really happened. We got them to extend that to 3 weeks, and she wasn't able to go then when it was all said and done with, and so I went with Seth DeBachman, the co-editor on World War III, and
passing yourselves off as radio people.
That's right. Before we left, Seth made some contact with some people from Prague, and showed them around New York. And in return, they said, "Oh well, here's the names of some people that you might call." So when we got over there. First, we were in Warsaw for a bit, and we took a lovely jaunt over to Auschwitz for the upbeat moment, and then went to Prague and met these people whose names we'd gotten, and then they in turn showed us around to some other people, and Havel was just about to be elected, and the atmosphere there was as close as I imagined to a just the fervor about somebody who was about to win in office was so great, and people were so enthusiastic, and it seemed like such a good thing that, you know, it was really, really exciting. The reception to comics was tremendous because, and especially I had brought some of Eric's comics with me. In fact, I think I brought home. Mm. That's a wordless comic. And what I found was that these people were flipping for this wordless stuff because they had basically comics, they had no comics to speak of. I mean, there's very little that had been done from what I had mm-hmm. seen.
There is a tradition of animation, at least,
there's
out of the
huge tradition of animation, but oddly enough, not comics. I had seen some of it, but it was pretty limited for what was available. And part of it was an American form, and that under communist rule, that was just generally like banned, and you know, people were turned away from it. But yet, you know, there was some of it being done, but you know, we were sort of hunting it out. But I was really excited by the idea that you could do how universal wordless comics can be in terms of communicating, and that what struck me as really important was that they were all excited about how great capitalism was going to be when it came rushing in there. And I was just like saying, listen, you know, we're talking about like homelessness. We're talking about, there's a lot of stuff that will follow with this, you know, joy of capitalism that is not this kind of dream scenario you're talking about. And that I know somebody who was there a year later and they had McDonald's and sounded like the place was trashed.
Maybe we should ask you to all put your headphones on. We're going to
take some calls.
We're going to take some calls. People have been lining up suddenly. So we're not going to do this for the rest of the program. We only have a few minutes, but people have been insistent, and let's hear what they have to say. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah?
Who cares?
Thank you for that
answer.
That's an excellent question.
Okay, let's take another call here. You're on the air.
Who cares, I said.
Well, this is a good... Let's take him one more time. Do you care?
No, I don't. No, I want to...
Okay, now, this is a good point to begin asking you about computers in the arts, since this jackass obviously has... managed to pull one out of his rectum in a time of need. Let's ask you.
I think
you
we should answer his question.
Let's get him
penetrating
up here.
Question.
What about using computers? You had said that among other people like Stephen Brodner, who's primarily a caricaturist, is working in computers. That there's a trend of people attempting to use computers. Does that have any appeal to you? Because if listeners, first of all, if they don't know. Your work, they ought to, but if they've seen the work, that both of your artwork tends to be rough and tends to be, even in reproduction, look very tactile. I mean, it looks very organic almost. Does that kind of stuff have any appeal to you personally, working in the high-tech vein?
Not particularly.
Yeah.
It has potential like any other tool, you know. I haven't seen much that has impressed me with computers. Computer art per se. I mean, technically, I'm sure in the hands of a great artist, it could you know, unlimited what it can do. But I think it's seen as kind of a shortcut for too many people. But it's no substitute for just you know, working with you know, the old-fashioned things they've had for hundreds of years. It's hard enough to master. So,
a lot of people are doing strange things like trying to replicate their graphic styles on computer, and I think a lot of times that's something that fails because the computer is really just a tool, and like any other tool, it has its own distinct characteristics. And it's, you know, you have to go through a period of growth and exploration where you're starting to look and see, well, what can it do that's different from other things? What can it do to be integrated with other mediums? But you know, like any new medium, it goes through a period where it just imitates the medium before it, and then eventually it learns its own language, and people who are working on it, you know, maybe in 10 or 15 years will have completely original things that are really appropriate with computer and really exciting that change, you know, the way we see things. But what isn't going to disappear is the great textural stuff that's created by hand, because that also has its own warmth and its own message.
One of the things I always liked about drawing or art is that I could just, you know, do something with a, you know, a piece of charcoal. You know, if they lock you up in jail, you could just use a match, you know, a burnt match, and you could do something on the wall. I've done this, so I know. Or you could, you know, you could just scratch something in the dirt. Something. I like the fact that it's very minimal, that you don't need all kinds of expensive tools or machines or things that plug in. You're not dependent on electricity or anything like that.
You know, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Like the caller asked, you know, who cares about computers? Information flow. You know, but where's the information? Where's the content, you know?
I, to a certain extent, I like the idea of not being also wrangled in by something that when it glitches out, you know, you're stuck. You know, I mean, it's hard enough to have the subways showing up, you know, on time and, you know, getting around. And even, you know, I use a copier a lot. And, even that, to some extent, I don't like being, you know, in a position where, if it goes out, I'm scrambling a bit. Like Jennifer was saying, I'm looking forward to things that are going to happen in the future with it that'll, and there, you know, there's aspects of it you can use, but most I'm interested in ink line, whatever's paint on paper.
Yeah. Acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating things is that people still care so much about illustration in the face of the information superhighway and this high-tech gobbledygook. And Jennifer Gilman, what's the most controversial thing you've ever published in The Voice in terms of negative reader response? Can you think of something offhand?
The most controversial thing we've ever about anything?
Yeah, about anything.
In the last year, I think one of the most controversial things was when we published a photograph of a man and a woman having sex on the cover of the Sex Factory store. They get
Gary Indiana piece about the porn industry.
About the porn industry, which was actually mostly about the gay porn industry. Basically, because for reasons of access, and the photographs that we had were not as much about the gay porn industry, also for reasons of access. And there was a huge controversy about that photograph, and was it homophobic to not, you know, were we shying away from two men
but
on the cover?
But you had put two naked men on the cover maybe 6 months
the year
earlier.
Before. Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was a film still.
Right.
Of two men. I mean, it wasn't quite as graphic. It was more romanticized, but it was still two men on the cover having sex.
And there was a great moment about that cover. Actually, on the Bob Grant Show, of all places, people were calling in complaining that these men were having sex. And Bob Grant went through a long monologue to try to explain that no, men could not have sex facing
in
each other.
Position.
Yes, it was a golden moment for ABC
that's how
Radio.
How much he knows. No, he was still on the air.
So there was a serious attack that you should have put a gay scene on the cover?
Yeah, and I think that these are valid concerns. I mean, I think that people who, you know, then went and read the story and discovered that it was really mostly about gay sex felt, it was paranoid in that it wasn't correct. We hadn't actually edited out, we didn't have pictures of gay men having sex that were good enough to go on the cover. They were crappy film stills. We thought it was much more important to have a photograph of the event, of the filming actually taking place.
Right, and as I recall, there was a, whatever it's called, a slapboard in front of the body, and sort of the way the bodies were, it looked like business. It was
a
very
you should have seen
photograph.
There was actually a photo that we did edit out that was either right before that moment or right after it that was so much more graphic, and it was really just a position of the body, and it was hot and really kind of scary to look at. I mean, it was very startling, and we didn't use that one. We used one that reflected the business as usual kind of aspect of this. And, you know, people were upset about it, and I can understand that, but I think there's also a bit of paranoia about, you know, was this something the editors decided to, you know, the issues would be taken off the stand, blah, blah. No, it really wasn't any of that. Although, actually, a lot of issues were taken off the stand with those photographs.
And The Voice was accused of pandering, right? The Voice was accused of putting the nudity on to sell papers.
Yeah.
And at least some of
but
the letters
we could
that
be accused
published.
Every week of trying to sell papers. I mean, that's, you know, we want people to read it. That's part of what we do. You know, you can take a pretty cynical view of that. And I think it's always some of both. It's always some of both.
Now, comic books, particularly in the World War III variety, have never shied away from dealing with violence. I believe that violence in all media is actually a good thing because it actually reduces the violence in the street. What do you all think of that?
Who cares?
Contrary to Janet Reno and others. There is a sort of cathartic purpose to violent illustration,
I suppose.
Eric, you think?
Yeah, that's that whole question of, you know, violence in the arts. Does it encourage more violence, or is it a catharsis, and then people experience it, and then they don't have to actually commit violence?
Look at Japan, where the violent content of comic books and mass media is much greater than in the United States. There's sadomasochism.
Yeah, but then they don't have the gun culture that we have here, as far as, you know, mass.
Oh, I think it's such a red herring. I mean, it has nothing to do with, I mean, violence, and whether it's reflected or created by the media, you know, it's a way of getting away from the real issue, which is economic. And I mean, the reasons that we have so much violence in this country are not because of television shows and, you know, Beavis and Butthead. I mean,
right, they scapegoat these cartoon characters.
It's a way of getting away from dealing with the real issues.
Right, it's a pale reflection of, you know, the violence, the economic violence that goes on all the time. It is. It's like a diversion. You know, me talking about, you know, blaming it on you know, some rap artist, you know, rock and roll, you know, some artist who's simply holding up a mirror or making a statement about the culture. You know, they'll, like, you know, it's like blaming the messenger. That old syndrome that they do over and over again.
And also the extent to which this stuff has been going on for a long time, and, you know, to, you know, sudden finger pointing at, you know, at entertainment industry, for example, as creating it, is sort of like, I mean, like you're saying, it's not looking at the issue at all.
Well, the other thing is that the minute you make artists responsible for their culture, you destroy their ability to be artists, because their whole thing is that we have a permission, in a way, to say whatever we need to say, to be as honest as possible about what's happening, about our environment, about all of that. And I mean, you could say that about the some of the gangster rap and the films that are coming out, that people think it's, you know, that every film has to be representative of a certain message and control a certain segment of the population and guide them. And I think that you destroy a lot of what art is, because you turn it into a controlled situation where your responsibility is not to your own vision, but to the greater culture. And I think that's a destructive force.
And with that, Jennifer Gilman, you have the last word. Stay tuned for Shelf Life at 4 o'clock. I think today it's Ben Cheever reading from The Partisan.
No, actually, Ben Cheever will be next week. Today it's Hoboken's own Brooke Stevens reading from his first novel just published.
At 4:30, Talk Back with Playfell Benjamin and Greg Thomas. And at 6 o'clock, the WBAI Evening News. Thanks to our panelists, Jennifer Gilman, Peter Cooper, and Eric Drucker. We look forward to your next visit to the show. And to Matthew Finch for co-hosting and doing the board. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week on the radio, 3 o'clock Thursday. Good afternoon.